This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating the world-class food and public organic... World-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard and Hopworks Bike Bar at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. October is National Co-op Month, and my guest today has written a book that suggests that co-ops, and along with a checkerboard of other strategies, might give us an actual viable and realistic alternative to entrenched corporate power, not to mention the dysfunctional democracy and staggering economic income inequality that we're all facing. Author and historian Gar Alperovitz is speaking to us from Washington, D.C., where he teaches political economics at the University of Maryland and participates in the Democracy Collaborative. In his most recent book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, Gar talks about how our present system is broken and the old traditional methods won't work to fix it. But his book is full of hope. He talks about a lot of things that are happening right now, real things that can allow us to change it. And most of his book is just full of examples and theories and things that are just fascinating. And Gar, you're on the phone right now, right?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Hello.
So anyway, it was a great book. And Gar, I just want to welcome you to KABU, and we'll start talking about this book.
Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to start just by, you say the system's broken. Could you say like the most specific sorts of like give us some examples and like in what kinds of ways it's actually totally broken?
Well, the difference between a system crisis or system being broken and just ordinary politics in one sense is if you look at long trends that get worse pretty much no matter who's in office, give or take a little ripple, you know something deeper is driving that. So, for instance, if you take the CO2 production, it's gone up 30% since 1970, and it's gone right straight through Democratic Republican administrations. Or if you look at poverty, it's gotten worse steadily over that 35-year track. Or if you look at imprisonment, which is really, most people don't look at it, which is a sign of liberty, we put about eight times as many people per capita into prisons than any other country, including Russia. We're way off the track, but it's gone up from about 90 per 100 in the 1970s. It's gone way up beyond that into an eightfold increase. So you could do this in different ways, but the long trends tell you there's something really strange going on that is deeper in the system. And one other part of that, just to give you one other example that's I write about in What Then Must We Do, the top 400 people in the United States currently, I mean, just 400, you could get them easily into a large assembly room, have more wealth now than the bottom 180 million taken together. And that's a sign of a dysfunctional system of such extreme concentration of wealth, almost medieval.
Yeah, like that's half of America, the bottom half of us, right?
Yep.
And like they have about $2 trillion between them.
Yeah, it's about 60%, actually, so it's more than half.
Wow.
They have more wealth than. Yeah, it's very, very concentrated, nothing like that historically.
Yeah, feudalistic, medieval, I like those kind of terms for it.
I use that term, I once said that in a lecture, that this is really medieval, and I meant it kind of clinically, or not sort of rhetorically. And a medieval historian came up to me and said, you know, you're wrong. It was never that concentrated in medieval times.
Never that bad.
Yep.
Right. And you talk, so these are like just some examples of like as you say, it's sort of trending worse and worse. But a lot of people are, you know, involved in like, well, we can just, you know, we change the politicians, we change, you know, or we just do real reforms, like we get out there on the streets and start demonstrating. And you're saying that kind of stuff can't fix it.
Well, let me be real clear. I think all of that is really important in building a social movement and electing the right representatives in House and Senate and locally particularly and in the state government. All of that's important. I wouldn't knock it. But I do think that unless we also begin to change the underlying institutions, that's not going to go very far. And I say that as at one point in my life, in my career, I was legislative director, both in the U.S. House and in the U.S. Senate, working for senators and directing their staff. So I've been on the inside seeing, you know, how the sausage is made, as they sometimes say. And I think the trends are now so powerful that although it's important to do whatever we can, unless we change the underlying institutions, working overtime from the bottom up, who owns wealth being the most important single thing, I think, for a variety of concerns, including environmental, I don't think we're going to change the trends. But that's long-term work. That's like the decades before the New Deal in the state and local, quote, you know, the state and local laboratories of democracy, where people developed things that were small scale, but at the right moment exploded into national significance. I think we're in that kind of an era right now where that's the kind of work that really counts.
And one last thing on this is that a lot of people though say that, well, you know, we did get the New Deal and we did get, you know, we had this incredible prosperity in the 60s. And why can't we just, you know, recreate a New Deal, for instance, you know, just...
It's a reasonable question. And, you know, part of the argument of the book, you know, What Then Must We Do, is that was a really very special and unusual moment in American history. Actually, two moments. One, the collapse of the economy in that period, also with a conservative Republican president. You know, if there'd been a Democrat in office, the Republican opposition would have, you know, capitalized on it. But there was a Republican conservative. And that meant gave an opening because of the great crisis, and labor unions began organizing, and new laws were changed. But I don't think we're going to see that kind of crisis again. I think we're going to, and the reason is government is three times as big as a percentage of the economy. It's got a big floor under the economy. We may see deepening stagnation of what the kind you see now and occasional upswings and down deep recessions, but that's different from a really total collapse, which opens the way towards a big politics of that kind. So I think we're not going to see that. Also, you know, the truth is, the strength of liberalism, and I used to work for liberal senators, Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day, I was his legislative director, liberal senators depended on the labor movement, and the labor movement's gone from about 30%, 34% of the labor force being members of unions. They're now down to about 11%. So that whole politics that depended on a crisis on the one hand and strong labor unions on the other to really pass important legislation, I really think that's over, unfortunately, and we're going to have to build a whole new base institutionally, like the co-ops and worker-owned companies and many things that are popping up.
We're going to start talking a little more about KBOO here, but I wanted to just let people know that we're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, your all-volunteer community radio station, speaking with political economist Gar Alperovitz about his latest book, Why the System is Broken and How We Can Change It. The book is called What Then Must We Do? And it's being offered as a premium for just a $60 donation to KBOO, so you could just call in. And I'd like to turn this over now to our Justin and Paul, who are working on our fund drive.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Indeed, we can give a copy of this book for a $60 minimum gift when you call, listeners, 877-500-5266. That's toll-free from anywhere in North America, 877-500-KBOO. We have a very modest goal for the Recovery Zone today, and I know we're going to get there with your help, $400. Let's go a little over goal. If four of you could start at sustaining membership of $10 a month, we could send you two copies of this book, and that would also take us over goal. You can do that online at kboo.fm, or you can call us toll-free, 877-500-5266.
You know what, Gar Alperovitz is speaking about are really community-driven solutions to these endemic, systemic problems that we all are all too aware of these days. And that's what we're all about here at KBOO. We're community radio. We're like grassroots from the ground up. We really reach out to people to support us at that level. We don't go to corporations. We don't go to big donors. We would have, we would love to have some large donors too, $100, $1,000. To us, those are large donors, $100, $500, $1,000. Anything you got, $20, $40, it all helps. It all adds up to reaching our goal. It all adds up to paying the bills here on KBOO. So please give us a call at 877-500, that's 500-5266.
You know, it turns out that how much you choose to give isn't as important as that you choose to give something, that you stand up and be counted, that you have your name entered into the KBOO Good Book. Because indeed, many hands make light lifting, and we will get enough dollars to do what we do. But what we want to do really is increase the number of supporters, to spread that responsibility around, to make stakeholders out of the listening community. And that's one of the things we're asking you to think about when we ask you to call 877-500-5266. Paul is exactly right. We don't take money from Bank of America when they call up. Oh, well, we hired a Spanish-speaking teller. We want to give you $25,000. Well, good for you guys. Sorry. We don't do that because we don't want the programming integrity to be affected. But you, dear listener, are what we worry about. You affect us with your money, and we affect you with our programming. So call right now. Let's affect each other, shall we? Toll free, 877-500-KBOO.
Hi, and I'm back again with Gar, and Gar Alperovitz, author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. This book is written in an incredibly easy-to-understand way, and Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker wrote, "This is not a utopian fantasy or a call for social engineering. This is a plain-spoken analysis by one of our leading economists of what's gone wrong and how to make it better." And so, Gar, one of the things that, I mean, or the main thing that I got from it through the whole book is that you know, we've focused a lot on sort of moral changes, like, you know, like equal rights for blacks, equal rights for gay people, for women. But that what's really called for now is kind of a democracy, a democracy of wealth. And could you talk about why that's just so important?
It's really, I think that's, we wouldn't, it's very important, the fights for liberation and gay rights and black rights and women, feminism. But, you know, in some sense, we hopefully are completing that revolution. It's all about equal treatment and getting into the system equally. But the system itself now is turned out to be really undemocratic. Money controls so much. Systems in general, historically, are largely oriented around who controls wealth. So feudalism, the lords and the kings and who had the wealth of land at that time really controlled the politics. Or in state socialism, the state controlled the wealth and controlled the politics. So if we're to build a new next direction over the next 10, 20 years, like the like the women did in the 19th century and the 18th century,
right,
and took the decade by decade to build up, we're going to have to change and democratize ownership of wealth to change politics. Fortunately, although the press doesn't cover much of this, there's a huge amount going on that people don't know about. For instance, there are 10,000 worker-owned companies right now in the United States. 3 million more people are involved than are members of unions in the private sector. There are 130 million people who are members of co-ops. People don't know that. 25% of electricity is distributed in the United States through city-owned, municipally-owned, or co-op, socialized, if you like, in America today. And if you actually, the book really kind of includes all this development that people, the press doesn't cover, But people are getting very, very interested in making happen. Another piece of this is, for instance, some folks know about the bank of in North Dakota, which is a government public-owned bank. It's been there for more than 90 years. Very positive. The state makes money from the bank because it's owned by the public, and the bank is supported by small businessmen, farmers, co-ops. Very successful, and there's 20 states that now have had legislation introduced to reproduce something like the Bank of North Dakota. So that's all, you know, if you probe a little bit, and a good part of my book about what then must we do is really reporting on things like this that the press doesn't cover much. There's an explosion going on around the country that the people are actually doing, which can be done almost anywhere. I can talk, if we have time, we can talk about some really exciting things, for instance, in Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah,
that'd be great. I mean, well, one of the things that, we could talk about Cleveland, Ohio. I'd sort of like to talk first, though, just about this whole idea of co-ops. Like, you talk about that being what you call evolutionary reconstruction. I mean, that's just like people owning their own businesses, people owning owning and being in power that way, right?
Yes. I mean, that's the key idea of really, instead of some big corporation owning it, or even, I have nothing against small business, but sometimes a small businessman will make money and run off to the suburbs. But a cooperative benefits all the members. And some of the cooperatives are anchored in community structures so that they're not just helping individual members, but trying to pour some of their profits into community development of the neighborhood and community. So, and it's a democratic form, one person, one vote. I mean, that's the key to all this. One person, one vote is critical. Take the credit union, for instance. Most people never think about their credit union. Well, there are a huge number of people involved in credit unions, and they control credit unions. Is a one person, one vote bank. That's really all it is. And if you put in all the money together that are in these credit unions, they are a cooperative. That's another name for a credit union. They have almost as much money, $1 trillion, as any of the big five New York banks. So in some parts of the country, we're seeing people, they're pretty kind of, in many cases, uninteresting, boring institution. They do auto loans and housing loans. Some parts of the country, activists have said, hey, nobody ever goes to these board meetings. Or why can't we elect our own folks and begin using them more creatively to help community development and help other co-ops and electing people to the board? It's a one-person, one-vote thing, and that's happening around the country, too, and not much reported on by the press, but certainly another interesting development.
And you talk about, I'd never heard of before, B Corps and employee stock ownership plans. So that's not like quite so a workers co-op, but these are also like other ways of workers really being involved in the workplace?
Yeah, they're slightly different. B Corp is, if you set up a private corporation, this is not worker-owned, but a private business with stockholders, the board and the chairman of the board and the officers are legally required to make money for the stockholders. So if they start spending the profits on social development, they can be sued, or if they, for instance, there's a buyout offer from a big corporation. This is what happened to Ben and Jerry's. They legally had to sell to the best offer, even if it, undermined their whole philosophy. And a B Corp, and I think there are about 11 states you can do this in now. Probably Oregon is one. I'm not sure. Is a particular form of corporation which is established with a proviso that it is in fact going to give money to social purposes. And that's what its purpose is. So it's a business company, but it has this proviso, which means that if you're an investor, when you invest, you know that's what you're doing. And so then it's fine legally.
Right.
And they're happening all over the country, too, to get using ownership for a social purpose, in this case through the B Corp form.
Okay, I just want to let listeners know again, this is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. We're speaking with political economist Gar Alpervitz about his latest book, What Then Must We Do? Democratizing Wealth and Building a Community-Sustaining Economy from the Ground Up. We're going now over to Justin and Paul, because you can have this book yourself with just a small donation to KBOO, $60. And I'd like you to just talk about, we can build community in KBOO as well as all over this country if we just all start working together.
Sure enough. And I'm Paul, and I'm with Justin. And yeah, you can get this book, What Then Shall We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution by the guest on KBOO right now, Gar Alperovitz. And that's a $60 minimum pledge. But to get that, or to donate just straight out, donate because you want to donate, is 877-500-5266. You know, as Gar was talking about, you know, people who, you know, a small business that starts and they start making good, they think they have great values, and then they just get too big or whatever, and the big guys want them and they sell out. Well, we're not going to sell out. We're not going to sell out our signal. We're not going to sell our values. But we're only as strong as our membership. We're only as strong as the people who contribute, the people who support the station by volunteering, the people who support the station by contributing money. That's where our strength is. And you're the ones, you're our rock. You're the ones who keep us from doing that, keep us from selling out and changing. We are going to stay the same. We're going to be true to our values, but we need your support in order to keep going. And the way to get your contribution into us is by calling up 877-500-5266 right about now.
We are givers, and we'd like to give away some more copies of this book, What Then Shall We Do? And we're making great progress. Pardon me, just $180. Pardon me, $180 to go. Three of you starting a $60 membership. You could do that on an electronic funds transfer, $5 a month. We can send you a copy of this book, What Then Shall We Do? 877-500-5266. I dare say we are the only station on the dial that is consistently questioning the growth paradigm. This notion that everything must be bigger in order to be better is, in fact, greatly responsible for the destruction of all that is holy. Now, that may sound hyperbolic, but the more we look at it, the more we're finding that's exactly what's going to happen. Now, KBOO will continue to change in certain ways, to adapt to changing needs, to adapt to new technologies, which we're working on. But one thing we're not going to change is questioning that growth paradigm, in questioning the notion that bigger is always better, in assuming that growth will make things better. The one thing we assume growth will make better is this station itself and growing the roles of membership. Paul is exactly right. And that's what we're asking you to do, regardless of the amount that you give, that you stand up and be counted, that you enter your name into the KBOO Good Book, that you make a gift to the entire community in favor of access, training, and programming. When you call 877-500-5266, you are diverting money from the clown show in Washington. That money is traditionally being used to grow things that need to be smaller, not larger, and to blow people up extrajudiciously. Or you could keep that money right here in Portland, serving free speech, serving access and training, and it stands here as a monument. 877-500-5266 is the way to do that. If you're anywhere on earth, most places do not have this vital community resource through terrestrial radio, so they're listening at KBOO.FM. There are thousands of you all over the world who are listening right now. Why don't you click that tip jar and start your membership? Or just call us up toll free anywhere in North America. 877-500-KBOO.
And if you're listening in Salem, if you're listening in Corvallis, if you're listening in Hillsboro, if you're listening in McMinnville, if you're listening out in the Columbia River Gorge, if you're listening up in Vancouver, Washington, we'd like to hear from you. Call us up. It's a toll-free number. That's 1-877-500-5266. And you know, if you're in Portland, if you've got five extra bucks in your pocket, 10 extra bucks, stop on by. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. We'd love to see you. We really love having people stopping by, checking out the station. I would also like to thank today's food donors. Really appreciate your support for feeding our volunteers during this membership drive. That's Grendel's Cafe at 729 East Burnside, Montage 301 Southeast Morrison Street, and Yenha at 6820 Northeast Sandy Boulevard.
It would be great to hear from people who are outside of town, because it's hard enough in the big city to get access to real people with real voices bringing real information unfettered by corporate interests. It's got to be even harder in the so-called hinterlands. You know, we changed the name of our neighbor across the river there with the new laws. Let's hear from Vansterdam. 877-500-5566. 5266. If you're in the Columbia Gorge, if you're in the Willamette Valley, if you're out towards the coast, we'd like to hear from you. That's why we have a toll-free number, 877-500-5266. We know that you give for your reasons, not for ours, but I believe that we are giving you reasons, listeners, every hour of every day for 45 years, for over 23 million commercial-free minutes. So please, think about all the times we have educated you, enraged you, entertained you, enticed you, enthused you, and call right now, 877-500-KBOO.
Hi, I'm back again. I just wanted to also say that Gar Alperovitz's book, What Then Must We Do, has another beautiful blurb from Daniel Ellsberg. This book offers by far the most serious, intellectually grounded strategy for system changing yet to appear. It could be the most important movement-building book of the new century, and thereby one of the most important political books as well. It's high praise, and the book is great. Plus, as I said, it's very easy to read. A lot of people described it as you're just sitting down and having a beer with somebody and talking about what's wrong and how do we fix it. And I want to talk more about co-ops, but I also want to make sure we get to like this other part of it that was seemed to be very, very important in your strategy. You called it impact investing, and it's like how municipalities and states can get really involved in like shifting us out of this situation. Could you talk a little about that?
Well, impact investing is kind of a general term. It's used largely now by very wealthy investors who are willing to invest, for instance, in worker-owned co-ops or land trusts or new businesses that are the B Corp we're talking about, socially positive businesses, but are willing to invest at much lower return. Some of them are willing to take 4% or 6% or 5%, which is for investing in businesses is a low return for these people. So that's the main part of impact investing. There also is money available. Most people don't realize this. Cities indirectly invest all the time in businesses. I mean, famously, they do it by giving essentially tax benefits, huge tax benefits to big corporations to come in. I mean, sometimes often $100,000 per job.
And the corporation might just turn around and leave,
Exactly the same. It's a very, very wasteful process. So, but many, there are also some ways they do it indirectly for small businesses and can do it for co-ops and worker-owned companies as well.
And so the idea being that these kinds of things are like I noticed that, for instance, CalPERS is doing a lot of public investment down in California. And this is the kind of thing that can what kinds of things are they investing in? You said B Corps, but also like utilities and
that is to say co-ops is a very important part of this, and land trust is a kind of either a neighborhood-owned or city-owned land development so that it doesn't gentrify immediately or some of the profits from land development can go back to the community, or as you said, B Corp. You need there are a whole series of things that are green in their orientation, that are just businesses that are, committed to ecological sustainability, and that's another part of this, or cooperative farming. There's a explosion of these kinds of things that, as I say, the press doesn't cover it, but the research that the folks here at the Democracy Collaborative have been doing, which a lot of it is in the book, concrete examples, show this, how much is happening that hasn't been covered. It just occurs to me, in addition to the book, What Then Must We Do, here's a website for people who want to know about this, which just gives a lot of, chapter and verse, and it's called community-wealth.org. Put the dash in, because there's one without, that's a different website. Community-wealth, and you'll find, leads to all kinds of things going on around the country or people are doing this sort of thing.
Community-wealth, that's great. And what do you say then to people who say, well, government involvement is just, it's just inefficient. We just, you can't work with the government. I mean, do you have an answer to that?
Well, except for all the other alternatives, it might be one way to say it. Consider this. The big banks, private banks, have been making that argument forever.
Yeah.
They just created $13 trillion in inefficient loss through recession.
Right.
$13 trillion. The healthcare system in the United States, which is dominated by insurance companies and private businesses, and hopefully is going to change over time, we get the worst health care in the world in advanced industrial countries. We are at the bottom of the list, and we spend twice as much of our economy that most countries do.
Yeah, 20% as opposed to 10 or something like that?
Something like that. It depends which year, 19% some years. But we're talking about $1 trillion in inefficiency by running it through the insurance companies, basically, and the private health system. Nobody ever looks at, or, you know, I'll give you another one because, you know, there's a whole chapters on this in the book. For instance, the airlines have beginning to cut back service to some cities. And the example I use in the book is Cincinnati. They think that's going to make a little more money for them because they don't quite have enough passengers there. Okay, efficient from their narrow point of view. Now, the city of Cincinnati loses transportation, which means businesses start closing and won't locate there.
Right.
So you have extraordinary costs that nobody counts. So this whole efficiency argument is really a, I mean, it's a bogus argument. It is true that that government is not efficient in many cases, often because businesses control the way it works. You know, right now the healthcare, the Obamacare, some of the features of Obamacare are just outrageous, but because business demanded them, particularly the insurance companies, so you've got provisions that make it inefficient. We can look abroad in some countries where you get, you know, some of this is less dominated by businesses, but that the efficiency argument, when you look at it closely, there are inefficiencies on both sides, but vast, huge inefficiencies due to the way corporations lobby or control or you know, speculate, like the big banks, causing a massive recession. People don't look at it that way, but there's a couple chapters in the book where I try to point out the efficiency argument is really, really
bogus.
Mistaken.
Yeah, bogus. And you also, you were going to talk about Cleveland. Could you tell us what's happening there and why you're so excited about it?
Well, Cleveland's very interesting, and the story I'm going to tell you is many cities are now doing just, they're not as far along as Cleveland. This is in a very poor part of Cleveland and a neighborhood of 40,000 with an average family, mostly black, family income of 18,000, very poor, 40% unemployment, so you get the picture. But 40,000 people. Right in the middle of that is a big hospital, Cleveland Clinic, famous hospital, then university hospitals, and Case Western Reserve University, right in the middle of that. They buy, taken together, $3 billion. That's with the B, $1 billion in goods and services a year. That's leaving aside construction and leaving aside salaries, just what they buy. None of it from that neighborhood. So, long story short, what's happened now, there are several co-ops set up together in the community to begin providing services and also building the community. And they're set up in a way, for instance, there's an industrial-scale laundry, that probably the greenest one in the Midwest, uses less heat and less water, doing you know, services for laundry for the hospitals and nursing homes in the area.
Mm-hmm.
There's the largest, these are not little co-ops, these are all organized as worker co-ops. The largest industrial-scale greenhouse in the United States is set up there as well. It produces 3 million heads of lettuce a year. And then there's a solar installation worker co-op. And they're linked together with a nonprofit corporation, so you're not just trying to make a small group of workers rich, you're trying to use some of the money to plow back into helping the community, and also into a loan fund to set up more worker co-ops in this complex. And then getting the universities and hospitals, which have a lot of public taxpayer dollars, Medicare, Medicaid, education money, saying, hey, we're going to focus some of our purchasing to help these community-building businesses. These are businesses that are not just designed to help individuals, though they are. They're also designed to build the community. So it's become called the Cleveland model of worker-owned co-ops, but linked together in a way that they can't run off. They're part of a complex that builds in the community, and they're financed by the local community nonprofit corporation. And to try to do this in a serious way, many, many cities are now doing this. Atlanta is well underway. There's a couple, three in the Washington, D.C. area. There's one in Amarillo, Texas. There's another one in Pittsburgh. There's another one in Cincinnati, just beginning to explode and realize this model, which is cooperative, but not just for cooperative community building, is really becoming interesting around the country.
Right, and then it's not like a corporation that's been invested in and that just decides to move 2 years later. These are people that live there, that work there, that have a business there that's dependent on the institutions that they're working for. In other words, it builds the community, is what you're saying.
And yep, that's exactly the whole design, so that you get those the money staying in the community and revolving, building up the community, and also under worker ownership. You know, so it's a very, right. very interesting model, democratic model.
And is this what you mean then by checkerboard strategies? That you're talk the whole idea of this is that these things start getting more and more linked together.
Yeah, around the country, you're seeing, you know, there are some states and very conservative states and cities that this isn't going to happen for a while. But, you know, other parts of the country, it really is happening and exploding. So, in a way, it's like a checkerboard where you're going to start surrounding the decaying cities, we think, with this all this new experimentation over time. Again, you have to have, if you think about this, you really have to have a perspective of, you know, if we're in pretty big bad trouble in the United States, and it's going to take building up a base over time, and ultimately, you know, we haven't talked about it, but ultimately politics connected with doing this kind of thing. To these are examples, you know, just developing. At some point, we're going to need policies to help them and rebuild the whole basis of local economies in this way as part of a political movement. We could talk about that, and there are also some things nationally, if we have time to talk about it.
Yeah, I would definitely want to talk about the national stuff. In fact, let's just do that now, and then we can talk maybe about how this all becomes like a coherent strategy. What is going on nationally? Like, how do you, and the idea of all of this is that you start local first, then move maybe to state, and then actually to national, right? I mean, it's the emphasis is on local.
Yeah, the emphasis on local, because you can't have a democratic society unless you have democratic communities where real people have real participation. So the emphasis is local. But also, you know, state banks like the Bank of North Dakota is another example, and 27 states invest directly public investment in businesses, and that's a growing movement that people don't know about. But nationally, there's some really big things that also may be happening, healthcare being the most important. I mean, we're in a jam over it, but I think ultimately healthcare is going to become increasingly some form of single payer. Vermont, you know, as Obamacare goes forward, even if difficulties there are going to shift some of the states. California passed single payer twice. Vermont is on the verge of transferring Obamacare to single payer, partly to control costs. And I think that's another process simultaneously going on. You know, that's almost 20% of the economy. So over the next 10, 20 years, I think we're going to see big movement there, mainly because all the other things are failing.
They just don't work, right?
They don't work, yeah. And you know, we just went through a big banking crisis, and most experts expect future banking crises. And I think we're going to get people very angry about what to do about the big banks. So I think there'll be some change there over time as well. So there are things happening at many, many different levels that partly, you know, a lot of what's happening here is, you know, good people trying to do good things, but also what's driving it is pain, economic and social pain, because the overall system is not working, and it's not working well for lots of people, and so they're really doing new things, not only because they want to do good things, but because either do, as in Cleveland, or it just gets worse. So it isn't just random stuff. It's that we're living in an era which is, you know, actually forcing people to either innovate in the way we're talking about, or it gets worse. So I think the process is being driven very powerfully by social and historical and economic forces.
Right. And actually the pain part of this really gets people thinking outside the box. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. And not only thinking outside the box, doing outside the
box. Doing outside the box,
yeah.
Right.
They have to, because the other stuff just doesn't work.
And some of the other possibilities for nationalizing, I mean, like General Motors got temporarily nationalized and AIG, but a lot of other countries don't have such a big problem with nationalizing big industries. Could you talk about that just a little bit more?
Yeah, I think we're going to see, you know, I think we're going to see more national crises because the political system is so jammed and the economic system's in trouble. We did nationalize General Motors and sort of nationalized Chrysler and nationalized AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the world, and it's still nationalized. So right now the business community and the business corporations can easily turn that to their advantage, and, you know, we put a lot of taxpayer money in, and then you give it back and sell it back to private. Well, you know, that's today. But if people begin to develop a whole different vision over time and do a lot of this stuff locally so they have different experience with, you know, neighborhood and city and public ideas about democratic ownership, maybe at some point down the line when we put a lot of taxpayer money in, there ought to be some ownership results of that as well. So I wouldn't rule out down the line
that this is possible. Yeah.
You know, people say we can't nationalize anything. We just did it.
Yeah. We're going back to just talking about KABU again here a moment, but this is the Recovery Zone on your all-volunteer community radio station, KBOO Portland. And we're speaking with political economist Gar Alperovitz about his latest book on why the system is broken and how we can change it. What then must we do? Democratizing wealth and building a community-sustaining economy from the ground up. This book is being offered as a premium for just a $60 donation to KABU. You just need to call in and talk to our lovely volunteers. And I'm turning this over again to Justin and Paul.
Yeah, I'm Paul, and I'm here with Justin. And we do know what we must do. This is our fundraising drive. We do this two or three times a year. And we do need to raise money to keep the station going. That's just the way it works. We all know that. Some of us might like to be in a different kind of economy, a non-money economy. But as we are in this money economy, we need to make it work for us. And to make it work for us, one of the participants in this experimentation in democratic communities, participatory communities, is community radio. Has been here in Oregon for 45 years here in Portland. And we're at 877-500-5266. And as Stephanie said, we do have volunteers waiting to take your call, eagerly waiting to take your call. So please do call us up at 877-500-5266.
Just $180 to go, dear listeners. $180 to go. I'd like to give away three copies of this book when you start your $60 membership or more. I want to thank Jim from Portland, who renewed his membership using, pardon me, a credit card. Richard is a brand new member. Thank you so much, Richard, in Portland. And he got a copy of the book. Won't you call right now? 877-500-5266. Less than 20 minutes to go to make sure we get our goal for Stephanie Potter and the Recovery Zone. Remember, every programmer you hear is a volunteer. They do this as a labor of love, and there's only one thing that they ask in return, and that is to make their program goal. It's a point of pride. It's bragging rights, and I think it's a small, small request. So please help make sure that Stephanie makes her goal by calling 877-500-5266. Be like Jim and Richard, and $180, we'll make sure we do that. Let's give away three copies of those books right now, 877-500-5266.
And we really do love our renewing members, people who have stuck with us over the years. And we also really like our new members. We'd really like people who haven't decided to take that plunge and become a full-fledged participant in this community radio experiment by calling 877-500-5266. Or you can come on down to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, or you can go online, kboo.fm. We're looking for some more new members, people who, you know, have been listening to KABU. They know what KABU is all about. They appreciate hearing interviews like this. But they haven't decided to contribute. They maybe didn't have the money before. Maybe now you do. Give us a call, 877-500-5266.
Okay, we're back again with Gar Alperovitz, author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Another little quote here. Naomi Wolf says this book is a fresh take on how to reinvigorate democracy and civic life, an analysis that transcends labels and has a real blueprint for action. And actually, one of the things I thought about this book is that it's so practical. I mean, it's like the kind of thing that actually could possibly bring some union to this conservative liberal divide that we have going on right now. And I was wondering, did you see it that way as well?
Well, the interesting thing that we discovered in some of these projects, I was talking about the Cleveland co-ops, and this is happening in different parts of the country. You know, this is a book that's talking about transferring in wealth to the vast majority from the top 1% or the top 400 who have more than 180 million people taken together. But that isn't most people. So if you go to cities like Cleveland, or you actually find small businessmen, or people may even call themselves a conservative. They're not conservative like Rush Limbaugh and rhetoric, and they're just conservative individually. We find that they like these things. They're practical. Workers owning is a good idea. They see them as businesses and constructive rather than welfare payments. They see them as building the community. Even willing to retired businessmen willing to help these radical cooperative projects. So it's very important, I think, to realize that there are many, many allies out there who labels don't quite get you to it if you actually are doing something real. And that's the key to it. You're getting away from rhetoric and building something positive. You'd be surprised what kind of support you have in some parts of the country among some people who are unexpected allies in this sort of thing.
And you said in the book, too, that the labor unions used to be kind of opposed to co-ops, but they're coming around as well.
You know, that's another interesting development. In the 19th century, worker ownership was part of the co-op, was part of the union movement. The Knights of Labor was for worker ownership. That all went by the boards, and for a long time, American unions were against worker ownership. The steelworkers, famously, I was working with steelworkers in Youngstown, and the local people wanted to set up a big worker-owned steel mill, which was possible because they had some big support from the Carter administration. But the national and the international union really was against it totally, strongly, and really, I think, helped kill it. That's all changed. Now, many unions are beginning to get serious, including the steelworkers, that they're backing a worker co-op model based in part on the Mondragon model. And it's a number of unions are involved in trying to help support worker-owned co-ops. And I think that's, you know, the wave of the future, particularly as unions realize that they're weakened and they better start doing innovative things or they're in real trouble. So we're seeing a change radically around the country.
And the Mondragon is actually working with the United Steelworkers to make this happen?
Yes.
Could you talk just briefly about Mondragon and why that's so exciting?
Well, Mondragon is a very famous, it's a complex 85,000 person, many, many forms of co-ops put together in the Basque region of Spain. And it's been there for about 55 years, and in many different industries. But it's very participatory. It is a co-op, but a series of co-ops linked together so that if your particular co-op gets in trouble or the businesses begin to not have a market, you can actually go to one of the other co-ops and almost certainly get a job because they're all linked together. They have their own bank. But you're talking about 85,000 people, and very, very successful. The top wages, top to bottom. This is a participatory multinational corporation, really, but it's a co-op, multifaceted, lots of little co-ops linked together.
And billions of dollars in business.
Billions of dollars in business, and it's participatory decision making. The wages, top to bottom, in 85% of the co-ops are 6-1.
Wow.
And, you know, American corporations, and maybe the top guy has 350 times as much as the bottom guy.
Huge differences, yeah.
And in the larger part of the Mondragon co-op, you know, it gets a little bit worse, 8 or 9-1. So it's still incredible by comparison to big American corporations.
And I was actually there in Mondragon, and I could not believe the solid apartments that everybody lived in. Nothing flashy, but it just felt very well taken care of, especially compared to the rest of Spain, where there's a lot of poverty going on right now. I mean, people really seem to be stable and safe and secure in a very different way. So anyway, but I'd like to get more into like this idea of a strategy. And we're going to run out of time again. Well, not quite, but anyway, the vision that you have?
Well, I think if you look at this, again, a lot of this is being driven by pain, by the failure of the existing system. And if you think about the end of the 19th century, how populism built up, or if you think about the history before the New Deal, I think we're in the prehistory of the next big progressive push. And I think it's going to revolve around new institutions because the old ones, labor unions particularly, are fading away. They used to be 34% of the labor force. They're down to less than 6 in the private sector and, you know, less than 11 all over. So I think we're going to have a new institutional base slowly, and the term is kind of slowly displacing some of the larger corporate functions if we build a politics around it. But this is politics for serious people for the long haul, beginning at the bottom and working up and having a long-term vision. One of the models for this, if you think about it, the conservatives in the 1940s were nowhere. They were totally lost, and they sort of rolled up their sleeves
and got to work.
And I think that's our job now, but around new institutions that actually alter who gets to own the wealth.
Well, stick around. We'll have a few minutes at the end here, but I just want to let people know again that we're going to the fund drive, the pledge drive here for KBOO. I'm talking with Gar Alperovitz about his book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, which can be yours for a small donation of just $60. Great book, very exciting, lots of good ideas of things that could really work. Turn it over to Justin.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. Yes, just $60 to go, dear listeners. $60 to go, 877-500-5266. Thank you so much to Ted in Portland for renewing. Ted upped his electronic funds transfer. Now, dear listeners, up yours. Diane in Portland is a brand new member. And both Ted and Diane got copies of this book, and I'd like to give away another. $60 will get us there, 877-500-5266. Please don't wait for someone else to do this. The time is now and the opportunity is yours. 877-500-5266. You can do that online at kboo.fm, or you can come on down in person and set up your new membership right now at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Yeah, we're here. We got some volunteers. They're ready to take your call. 877-500-5266. 877-500-5266. That's the number to call. We can't say it enough because that's how we stay on the air. That's how we are supported by you, and we support your efforts at community building. We are trying our best to build community, to do the kind of things that Gar is talking about. We encourage participation. We encourage participation in the station. We encourage people to volunteer. We help people volunteer. We help train people to do all the tasks we need to do the station. But in order to do all that, the bottom line, unfortunately, or fortunately, however you look at it, is 877-500-5266 to support this station.
Like it or not, in this society, how we spend our money says something about the life we intend to lead. Now, that could mean buying gold underwear, or it could mean supporting an august free speech organization. And I know that times are tough, but we're not asking to break your bank. Sustainability is an important model, an important paradigm here at KBOO. And I know that there are a lot of organizations fighting for your hard-won pennies, nickels, and dimes. But if you could only support one, what kind of organization would it be? Would it bring you news about the next American Revolution? Would it invite your participation at every level of the organization? Would it have withstood the test of time, 45 years and counting? Would it be an electronic bulletin board for all the area social change activism that's going on? Would it have a music library of over 50,000 CDs, over 30,000 LPs? In short, my friends, would it be KBOO? Please say yes and call right now, 877-500-5266. We're working our way towards a $125,000 goal to keep your community radio station thriving. We do it with you, by you, and for you. 877-500-5266.
And we have done well this past hour. We still need a little bit to go to get our goal. I guess I hate to say this, but it has been a little bit of slow today. We've been doing really well on this pledge drive up to now. We've been really plugging away, getting towards our goal. And we're almost to $90,000. Help us push it over $90,000 today. Help us get towards our $125,000 goal by Saturday. The only way to do that is calling 877-500-5266.
How many opportunities today will you have to be a hero for the entire community, to engage in a bit of checkbook activism without breaking the bank, to ensure access, training, and programming for anyone who cares to have it, to ensure this radio tapestry of diverse voices from all the different communities in the area? How many opportunities will you have to stand up and be counted today with just just a small amount of support. $60 over the whole year is $5 a month. It's one penny, one nickel, and one dime towards the more than $2,000 a day it costs to keep the Mighty 90.7 on the air. 877-500-5266. Other media sources are delivering you into the hands of advertisers, whereby we are delivering information into your hands. It enriches your life. It enriches your family's life. It enriches your neighbor's life. It enriches people you don't even know. And if you don't do it, who will? 877-500-5266. We're very thrilled with everyone who has called in, but there's always room for more of you. And 9 of every 10 who are listening haven't made that call yet. We're not here to guilt you. Paul and I aren't here to guilt you. We're here to end that guilt. We're here to liberate you. We're here to set you free and be healed. 877-500-5266. We're laying down the truth and letting you sort it out. We bring as many voices to the air as we can and ask you to call and make it possible. Toll free, 877-500-KBOO.
Hi. Back again. One last little quote. David Corton, Agenda for a New Economy. The move to a broadly participatory, locally rooted cooperative ownership is essential to America's future. Gar Alperovitz presents a brilliant, accessible, and practical plan of action to make it happen. And it is a plan of action. It's not about just complaining about what's wrong with this stuff anymore, right?
Yes, and you know, the thing that's interesting, and what I try to cover in What Then Must We Do, lots of people are doing this. And the press doesn't cover it. So the idea that it can't be done is just wrong. There's a huge amount going on around the country, and people really need to face that there is a lot that can be done, and there's a movement building up step by step that I think is going to really start getting powerful, mainly because, you know, people are in a box. You either do something new, and this is the direction, or things get worse, and I think that's what's driving all this.
And this movement would displace capitalism. Is that actually sort of how you see it going forward?
Well, I think,
or corporations.
Corporate capitalism, the current large scale system. I think there are a lot of small businesses that's not our problem. The problem in many cases are these giant insurance companies and the big banks and the big Exxon and oil companies and the global warming, et cetera. So it's at that level where the big problems are occurring, but the key is to build a society that is more democratic, and that means democratizing the ownership of wealth. Otherwise, the people with concentrated wealth control. And if you take it for the long haul, that means building it up step by step from the bottom, so that we actually have experience with what this means. And as I say, 130 million people are members of co-ops already, and 10 million in worker-owned companies of one kind or another. This is the sort of thing that can be made even more democratic, and is being made democratic, as some of the examples we talked about over the last hour, or the book is filled with them. But again, that is the precondition, changing what's happening on the ground so that people in their own lives experience something different. I think that's the basis for a really serious next politics. And I think that's what we're into right now.
And it gets people into the idea that, yes, I can do something, and that there is actually a possibility for change. I see it as like you're feeling like this can work, basically. People sort of have now a sense of, oh, it's just too overwhelming, and there's nothing we can do. But as you say, the media is part of the problem here.
Yeah, that's the most interesting thing I'd learned. I was on a book tour, and people really don't know about these things. The media doesn't tell them. But once they begin to see that what people are doing in many, many communities, which the press doesn't cover, there's a hopeful politics in this if you're willing to roll up your sleeves and get to work. And in many, many cities, that's just what's happening under the radar.
And we, again, have liberty, justice, and equality for all in this country. Seems like that would be the direction.
And ecological sustainability.
And ecological sustainability. Oh, gosh, that's a huge one. And any just last words that you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I wrote the book. This, if you really read this book carefully, it's rooted in a big, big academic research thing. But I wrote it in a style that I've never done before, but it's very personal and people do tell me it's easy to read.
Easy to read, yes.
It's a movement-building book, but it's anchored in a whole lot of research that doesn't get in your way, I think, unless you want to go look at footnotes. But it's an attempt to put together a pretty hard-headed historical and economic argument, but translated into ordinary English. And my experience is that if you can't explain it to ordinary folks in ordinary language, that means you probably don't understand it well enough. And so I think a lot of academics could do well if they tested it on people, you know, around the corner from their house.
Well, I just want to thank you again for being on the show, Gar. This is The Recovery Zone on your all-volunteer community radio station, KBOO Portland. We were speaking with political economist Gar Alpervitz about his latest book on why the system is broken and a vision for changing it. What then must we do? Democratizing wealth and building a community-sustaining economy from the ground up. Straight talk about the next American revolution. This has been The Recovery Zone. As I said, I'm Stephanie Potter, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, dedicated to helping working adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including an MBA in healthcare management with evening, weekend, and online options. Listeners can learn more at the information session on Thursday, November 7th at 6:30 p.m. Details at merrillhurst.edu.
This is KABU Headline News at Noon for October 23, 2013. I'm Diane Erickson. In local news, a Beaverton resident and former head of a national charity was charged with wire fraud and money laundering on Sunday upon his return from a month-long trip to Japan and Thailand. Brian J. Brown, who has pleaded not guilty, formed a nonprofit called Charity One, Inc. after leaving National Relief Charities in 2005. Brown then persuaded National Relief Charities to provide $4 million in funding to Charity One, purportedly to provide educational scholarships to Native Americans. The charge is that Brown and a number of other co-conspirators used the money for personal gain. In national news, a new poll has found increased dissatisfaction with the Republican Party across the country after the government shutdown. The Washington Post ABC News poll found that if a congressional election were held today, nearly half of all citizens would vote Democratic and only 38% would vote Republican. 8 out of 10 Americans disapprove of the shutdown, and most voters believe the shutdown damaged our international reputation and hurt our economy. More than half of the respondents blame the Republicans, while about 30% blame the president. The shutdown also weakened the Republican Party internally, exposing significant divisions between Tea Party supporters and mainstreamers. The Labor Department reported yesterday that the U.S. jobless rate fell in September to 7.2%, while new job creation remained slow. 148,000 jobs were